Hello and welcome to Raven Anthology. I will be your host for the next hour, and we have got a great show in store for you today. We have here on the air with us Alexis Smith, author of Marrow Island. Alexis, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah. Where are we finding you?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
Uh-huh. And your book, Marrow Island, it came out in June, is that right?
It did, yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you you want to tell us a little bit about it? And then I'll give you a little introduction here.
Sure. So Marrow Island takes place in Washington State in the San Juan Islands, and alternately in alternate chapters in the Malheur National Forest in Oregon. And it follows, our protagonist is Lucy, and she's a journalist. She's in her late 20s, early 30s. And we follow her as she goes back to the island that she grew up on in the San Juans, and where there was a big earthquake and where her father died in a petroleum refinery fire. And she's going back to the islands to see an old friend and also to investigate what has happened on Marrow Island after the earthquake, where the refinery fire caused some ecological devastation. And there's a small group of quasi-religious back-to-earth types who've gone to the island to see if they can minister to the island and rehabilitate the ecosystem there. And so she is, both as a reporter and a person who lived there, going back to find out what happened. Mm-hmm. And you know from the beginning that not all is as it seemed, and that something terrible happens to her while she's there. And it's sort of, the novel follows her recounting what happened there on the island.
Mm-hmm. And it just works itself to this incredible, scary, really terrifying climax. But, yeah, I wanted to hear you briefly on the book before saying that you were born and raised in the Pacific Northwest. Was that Portland?
I was born in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
And both of my parents grew up in Alaska, my mom in Anchorage and my dad on the Kenai Peninsula and down in Kenai and Zlotna. Mm. And so we lived there until I was 10. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Seattle, and I moved to Portland in 1999. So I have been just in this corner of the United States for my entire life.
Right. So you know it well, and that's definitely reflected in the book. I should say, in addition, that Alexis's debut novel called Glaciers was a finalist for the Ken Kesey Award for Fiction and also a World Book Night selection. That was in 2013. It's been translated into Spanish and Italian. And you were at Mount Holyoke and then Portland State University, and you have an MFA from Goddard College. So you were at Mount Holyoke, so not your entire life in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. Yeah, I spent 2 terms at Mount Holyoke, so a little bit of time in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And the program that I did at Goddard was Goddard's in Vermont. It was a low residency program, so I was living and working in Portland and then going out to Vermont twice a year to do conferences with my advisors and working remotely on my degree. Still staying in Portland, so a little bit of time, yeah, in New England, but
right.
Mostly here.
Wonderful. And Marrow Island, did you spend a lot of time in the San Juans? I know that Lucy, your main character, grows up on Orwell Island, which is near to Marrow Island, where most of the action takes place.
Mm-hmm. Those are both fictional islands in the San Juans, but based on islands that if I haven't been to them, I've been to very similar islands there. I didn't spend a lot of time in the San Juans, but having grown up in both in Alaska and also in the Puget Sound area, having taken the ferry to many of the islands in and out of both the southern and northern end of Puget Sound throughout my childhood. You know, I spent a lot of time just in the region, and the landscape there is really striking to be so close to a city as big as Seattle, and to find yourself feeling so remote. It's, you know, I think islands really capture the imagination in that way. There are a lot of great books about islands, and I think a lot of people who maybe live in Seattle or other places dream about, you know, finding that island somewhere where they can just sort of go and disappear and just cut off ties to the city life or you know, the mainland, and live a sort of fantasy, rural fantasy. But yeah, I think having grown up in the area, I definitely was influenced by all of that.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we can just start there. I mean, was there a specific point when you were writing Merrow Island when you decided to fictionalize these islands? I mean, I'm thinking of maybe Snow Falling on Cedars, and I think the author of that, David Guterson, renamed Bainbridge Island, I think, to San Pedro or something like that. And,
That makes sense, yeah.
And then also, I mean, in my book, I made the decision to rename Baranoff Island, where I am now, to New Archangel, mm-hmm. and rename the town. And I'm wondering if that was a conscious decision or whether you just started off there.
It was definitely a conscious decision. And part of it was because I was already playing with geological time by making an earthquake happen in the 1990s, like a big earthquake in Puget Sound. So I already kind of felt like I had the leeway to just mix things up on people.
Sure.
But mostly it was because I didn't want anyone to have an attachment to a specific idea of what one of the islands already is. You know, I didn't want anyone to be thinking of Friday Harbor, say, when I was talking about the small town on Orwell. And, you know, I didn't want people to necessarily be thinking of, like, the refinery in Anacortes when I was talking about the refinery that I put on Merrow Island. So, you know, in some ways I wanted people to know the environment but also sort of be able to free themselves to not attach it to a specific place that they already knew.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess it just allows you a lot more leeway as far as your imagination goes, just to create, like you're saying, create the world as you see fit.
Well,
before speaking too much about the book, maybe we can have you read a section. And I will say, I think that the parallels between your story, Merrow Island, and even the situation we find ourselves in here on Baranoff Island, there was a big mill closing, I guess in your book it's about 20 years ago, here, so at 92, so a little less than that, but people really kind of dealing with figuring out how to live in the woods in isolation. I think the situation's a little bit more dire in your book, but certainly parallels and a lot to relate to for folks here reading your book. So, yeah, did you have a section in mind you wanted to read?
I thought I might read a little bit just from the prologue, because it sort of sets up where we are when we start the story, and also gives you sort of a sense of what happens at the end. And I think I'll just start there.
Great.
Give myself a little drink of tea before I start, so that my throat doesn't totally break up while I'm reading.
No problem.
This was my last glimpse of Merrow Island before the boat pulled away. Brown and green uniforms clustered on the beach, tramping up the hill to the chapel and through the trees to the cottages of Merrow Colony. The boat wasn't moving yet, but the uniforms already seemed to be getting smaller, receding from my sight, shrinking into a diorama, a miniature scene of the crime. Carrie had helped me into the boat. I sank to the wheelhouse deck and curled into myself, knees to chest, spine to prow. Joshua Coombs was calling out on the radio requesting an ambulance to meet us in Anacortes. Katie tried to come aboard, but Carrie hollered something to her and she ran back up the dock. He squatted next to me and spoke softly just by my ear. We need to take off your clothes. They were soaked through. I wouldn't be warm until I was dry. I understood that this was first aid. I understood that he was just doing his job as park ranger. I just didn't have it in me to participate in my own rescue. I was spent, scraped, and bruised. I leaned into him, eyes closing. Stay awake, Lucy, he said, a little longer. Listen to my voice. He lowered me carefully to my back, his parka under my head, and called the teams for scissors. He kept talking, narrating as he undressed me, threading one arm through a sleeve, gently rolling me, tugging the shirt up my torso, lifting my head. I knew his hands were on me, but through my cold flesh, they felt like the mitts of a giant, huge and heavy. He took off my socks. My shoes were long gone, in the field, in the ruins, in the woods. And he cradled my heel in his palm as he lowered it to the deck. My thoughts had stopped making sense. I tried to visualize Carrie's words as he spoke. I have to cut these off. Then he slid the small, sharp scissors up the outside of my leg through my jeans. He hesitated around my hip. Please try. Can you be very still? I was shivering. He rubbed my legs up and down under the blanket, telling me about circulation, about blood, about heat. I drifted. Stay awake, Lucy. Coons was starting the boat. Katie came back with more blankets. Carrie told Katie to get down on the deck and wrap herself around me. She lay down beside me on Carrie's parka, pulled me into her body, rubbed my arms and back. He covered us both with the two blankets. I breathed into the wool as the boat lurched through the swells, nausea rising up instantly. Katie seemed never to stop panting from her run up the shore. The bass beat of her heart, the thrust of the boat through the waves, the feeling of fullness at the back of my throat. I wanted to purge everything inside me, but my bearings held. Don't let her go, I heard Carrie say. At the hospital in Anacortes, they treated me for hypothermia, but they were confused. I was going through more than one kind of shock. Carrie had told them I'd been lost on Mare Island overnight. He didn't know the rest yet. And they saw his uniform and took his word. When they asked me what and when I had last eaten, I shrugged. Though I remembered my last meal well. The mussels, the heady broth, the bread, the wine, the birch liquor, and the cramps in my stomach that started not long after. The memory of food brought on the first hunger pangs. The craving for energy, for heat, my metabolism waking up. They were so strong they stabbed at my guts, but the nausea lingered. I couldn't imagine putting something in my mouth, tasting and swallowing. Katie told the intake nurse she was my sister, and I didn't correct her. They let her sit by my bed all night. I'm not leaving you alone with her, Carrie told me. She was standing right beside him when he said it. But she didn't defend herself. I didn't know what to say. I wanted them both. Katie held my hand for hours while my temperature rose and patches of my flesh became livid. I could feel the drunken movement of blood and plasma through my body, my cheeks throbbing, my toes and fingers buzzing. My breath felt like meat cold from a locker. Eventually, Katie slept, head next to mine, nose to my cheek, like when we were girls, like that first night after the quake, clinging to each other under a mylar sheet in the gymnasium. I listened to her sleep. I felt her moving through her dreams. Carrie sat in the chair by the door, waiting for the sheriff, though he shouldn't have. He should have been back on Marrow at his post, taking the state troopers through the woods, writing official reports. Soon enough, everyone would be looking for us with questions. But they would find what they were looking for at the colony without our help. And by the time they asked me to tell my part, they would have a story of their own, and they wouldn't veer from it, no matter the details I offered. In the weeks after, back in the city, I awoke alone in my third-floor apartment every morning. Outside, buses lumbered down Fremont Street. Shopkeepers turned over their open signs. People drank their coffee, checked their phones, walked their dogs. The city repeated its relentless, noisy cycle like it had every day before and after that week I spent on Marrow. I listened. I watched. After the Mayday quake over 20 years before, Seattle had rebuilt itself from concrete rubble heap back to Silver City. Lessons learned, so we tell ourselves. Otherwise, what was the point of it all? What unlikely comfort we find in the refrain, build, destroy, repeat. There are always survivors left to pick up the pieces. There's always someone to tell the tale. I had my own refrain. I told the story of those days on Merrow Island hundreds of times in the first few months to the state police and the FBI, the grand jury, my fellow journalists, to the editors who wanted me to write a book, and even, because of Sister Jay, the Archbishop of the Seattle Diocese. I answered their questions honestly, and all the details were true, but the telling began to feel like a betrayal. I told them the story, and they typed it up, and it became tabloid television lurid. Merrow Colony is cult. Merrow Colony is failed utopia. Build, destroy, repeat. From my hospital bed, from my apartment, from the courtroom, I saw Merrow Island and Sister's Colony pillaged. And all the people there who were scraping out a little space for themselves, their only hope to live gratefully, daily, in the service of the planet, they were evicted, displaced, incarcerated. Now I am 500 miles away in the dry, pine-scattered forests of eastern Oregon. But every time I dream, I find myself back on the islands. In some dreams, I relive the events as they happened. In others, I realize I'm dreaming. And I try to undo the past, to make different choices. Either way, I wake up feeling lost. How did I get here? How did this happen? I might be the only one left who knows. The newspapers have moved on to other catastrophes. The colony's history will fade into archives. The colonists will become ghosts. No one will remember the names of those who performed a miracle on Merrow Island. I have never said so to anyone, not even Carrie. But I forgive them. I forgive them for trying to kill me.
Thank you for that.
That's prologue.
Yeah, that's a great reading. Really sets the hooks in you. I want to know what happened and, geez, why they tried to kill Lucy. and on top of that, how she can forgive them. But yeah, so some of the people talking about your book have characterized it as an environmental thriller, which I thought was real interesting. What do you think of that?
I don't know how I would have characterized it myself. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's as good a genre as any. I don't know. I think that I'm in a tradition of kind of literary fiction that is somewhat psychological and takes the landscape into account, like you might find in some Margaret Atwood, mm-hmm. Who is one of my favorite writers and a big influence on me. So I think that environmental thriller or eco-thriller, these are sort of new terms for books that we find ourselves reading or reading about a lot more lately, books that maybe deal with imagining a future where climate change has advanced and people are trying out different, you know, methods of survival in whatever region they're in. And usually, you know, hopefully there's more to the story than just that, but, you know, the human element is always what draws us in. And, I'm cool with it. I think it's a good genre.
It strikes me just as hearing it to be something incredibly hard to pull off. I mean, forgive me, but when I think of environmental writing, especially in the world of fiction, it just seems like it's going to be deadly boring unless you're very into that sort of thing. So to be able to pull off a thriller and to knit, you know, thriller to environmental, I think you pulled off something rare and incredible. Yeah, I mean, you mention human accountability and this whole idea of a literature of environmentalism or ecofiction, whatever people might call it, and it seems to presume or at least be interested in this human connection to nature and wanting to take a look at that. But yeah, I think it all, maybe in its newest incarnation, it's also kind of taking the view that, you know, the self and human interest isn't the only interest that's out there, and that issues of accountability and how we act in nature or the wild or whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
is also something that deserves to not only come under the lens of you know, nonfiction and op-eds and that sort of thing, but also fiction and stories.
Definitely. I think, you know, you're describing environmental writing as being deadly boring, or maybe that's just a presumption of what environmental writing might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of think about, like, 19th century naturalists or something like that. Like, you know, it might seem in theory to be really, really great, but then when you sit down to actually read them, it's sort of a slog. You know, you get a few really wonderful lines, but then it doesn't really apply to today in some ways, and so it just doesn't really, it's not as compelling, I guess.
Right.
I definitely really love some, I don't know if I call them environmental writers, but definitely writers who engage with the landscape, or many different landscapes. Like Barry Lopez is one of
mm-hmm.
my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he manages to not be boring, you know, when he's writing about the environment, either in fiction or in nonfiction. And I think that he's, you know, when we look back, that he might be sort of this era's, you know, first great environmental writer. At least of the Northwest, you know, he writes about lots of areas, but, you know, having written about the Arctic and, he lives here in Oregon. So, you know, a lot of the landscapes are familiar to me. I think what's most appealing to me in this idea of fiction that is engaging with the environment, is that there does seem to be so much to be afraid of right now. You know, if it's not, a natural disaster, like here in the Northwest, where we're waiting for the big one, or, you know, the seasonal wildfires, you know, then it's this huge looming idea of climate change, which seems totally unapproachable. And like, how are we actually going to do anything about this? You know, whether or not you believe that humans are responsible or are in any way responsible, there's this fact that we're going to be dealing with a planet that is changing. And I think that fiction just offers possibilities for the imagination to work those problems out. You know, it's a little bit of prognostication, and it's a little bit invention and human ingenuity. You know, it's just putting our minds to work on problems that we maybe don't really know how to grapple with, especially a lot of us who aren't scientists or, you know, naturalists. I think it gives us a pathway to just think about those things and maybe imagine a way of surviving.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it seems like nonfiction, it's go-to or even journalism is, when you talk about prognostication, is just fear, right? I mean, I guess I'm thinking of, is it Catherine Schultz, the New Yorker article,
right,
about,
mm-hmm.
you know, the really big earthquake that's going to hit the Pacific Northwest. And, God, man, I mean, I mean, scared the heck out of me. I mean, she
mm-hmm.
just details exactly what would happen, right? I mean, this must be something after your book you're interested in. In fact, I know it is because I heard you speak about it on a panel. You know, and I don't know what it is, but it seems like fiction, that element of scaring people into action, it's not how fiction goes about things. It's more opening up. It's telling stories and opening up paths for the imagination that, rather than scare people into action, allow them to imagine mm-hmm. themselves in action or something like that.
Yeah, it's when we get so attached to characters. I mean, it's whether it's I was really into baseball with a high school friend of mine who was a Mariners fan when we were growing up, and I used to talk about the players as characters, and she would just sort of chuckle at me, you know.
Yeah.
Like they're not characters, they're players. I was like, but to me, they're characters. This is how I understand baseball. We've got, you know, there's Randy Johnson. He's a character to me. You know, that was how I understood baseball. And I feel like that's sort of the way that I can approach these big problems in the environment, too. It's like through characters. And so if I am not seeing those characters out there, I'm going to make them up. I'm going to make up those characters, and I'm going to put them in that situation. I think it helps people to have that, you know, the empathy that we have for the characters in books. I mean, who hasn't ever cried at the end of a book or, you know, or been so angry you've thrown a book across the room or something like that? They engage our emotions enough that I think that these things that, you know, the Catherine Schulte article really stymied a lot of people, I think, and made them feel like, oh, crap, I'm just going to have to stockpile water in my basement and then just pray. Like, you know, there were a lot of people who just really, it was terrifying. And that was it. It was like, it was terrifying. That was it. And I'm just going to, you know, push it from my mind. But when we have characters that we have sort of lived with in fiction, I think it is definitely easier for us to imagine those things really happening. And you know, maybe like part of writing this book was for me kind of imagining what surviving an earthquake would be like. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that I think about that scares me. And I mean, the article came out after I wrote this book, but that's definitely the way that I approached researching the earthquake that was going to happen. And I think that it was definitely a little bit of therapy for me. And, you know, maybe that's why a lot of people are going to go increasingly to these kinds of books.
Right. I teach an online course called Writing the Wild at Stanford, and it's always incredible to me to see. It's essentially a survey of nature writers, you know, beginning with those folks in the beginning of the 19th century up to our contemporary moment. And it's always incredible to me the writers that really hit people. And it's funny you mentioned Barry Lopez, because you'll get people responding very academically to Thoreau and Muir, mm-hmm. and those folks. But Lopez, he gets people on an emotional, mm-hmm. level. And it always reminds me of that quote, I think it was Maya Angelou or somebody, you know, people will forgive you for things that you did, but they'll never forgive you for making them feel certain ways. I'm butchering that, but that's kind of the general idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Lopez, he really makes you feel stuff on so many levels. And
Definitely,
I wonder if that's just his ability as an environmental writer, just to tell a story. I mean, he obviously has so much respect, mm-hmm. for stories, instead of just to give a sketch. And so, not to get too far afield, I want to come back to your book. You know, I think maybe you earned that title of environmental thriller because, I mean, the essence of a thriller is just a really good story, you know, one that enthralls you and kind of has you by the throat. And, you know, maybe that's something that you admire in Lopez and something that you're in turn pretty good at, just telling a good story, but also bringing in all these questions into play over what is our role in humans when it comes to remediation of damaged land, and how do we get to the next step? I mean, there's reference in your book that, you know, blood needs to be shed before things will get better. And, you know, it's complicated is what this sister Janet out here that's trying to, is kind of like this charismatic leader to this, I don't want to call it a cult, but to this group of, what is it, 36 folks out there on the island doing their best to make the soil better, to make the groundwater better after this terrible earthquake. You know, she's a good person. She tells a good story and she gets these followers, and then everything kind of falls apart in this dramatic way. Anyways, I'm not quite sure what my point there is, but maybe just that everything comes back to just a really good story, a really good kind of narrative flow. And, And that's one thing I definitely admire in this book.
I think that there is, in terms of what to call them, I was calling them an intentional community for a while, and then sort of got called to task by some friends of mine who grew up in, like, hippie communes. And but I think that because, I didn't do a lot of research on what intentional communities were, I just imagined that these were the people that were going to come together around this leader and move to this island and take on this project. And so cult is not necessarily the wrong term. I don't know that intentional community is the wrong term either, but they're sort of political, but sort of not. Then they're sort of hippies, and they're sort of not, and they're sort of Christian, and they're sort of not. There's a lot in this group, and I think that the one thing that I really wanted to stress about them is that no matter what their specific methods were or beliefs were, that they were following in a long tradition of sort of people setting out into a wilderness with specific intentions and having those intentions go awry. that there are these patterns of human behavior, especially, Western human behavior of, advancement across a wilderness and varying degrees of success and, triumphs and failures. And, they call themselves a colony in an unironic way, I think. But for me, them calling themselves colonists was very specific.
I have to tell you, Alexis, when I first came to Alaska, I was 19 in 1997, and I ended up going out and living in the woods for, I guess, about 10 months. And there were folks farther up the river. First, I lived in a tent, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was kind of coached by a friend, and he showed me the ropes. I'd been camping in Pennsylvania and along the Appalachian Trail, but hadn't really done a ton. He showed me the ropes, but there was this crew of folks farther up the river that were kind of training for the apocalypse, and they were led by this guy, tattoos on his face, really nice guy at the time, but and they insisted on only using tools that came from deer bones and hunting and foraging for all their own food, and lived in this ramshackle kind of plywood trash bag area called the Chateau. And it was funny reading your book. I kept thinking back to them, and it didn't have the religious overtones that the colony does out on Merrill Island, but it definitely had that rigid sense of purpose. And also a peculiar kind of smell of desperation to it. And that's just kind of me remembering it. But I was reminded of it reading Merrill Island, because you don't necessarily approach it. Maybe you do at the very end when everything, begins to fall apart. But just in Katie, and Katie is Lucy's very good friend from childhood, who initially invites Lucy out to the island once Lucy loses her job as a journalist, right? Like an eco-journalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they kind of rekindle their friendship. And as I said, you don't ever hit it directly, but there is this sense of almost trying too hard to convince Lucy that this way of life is working and it's viable, and and she should totally buy into it.
Yeah. One of the really difficult situations they're in is that if they're, they're there because no one else wanted to be there, because it was environmentally not a good idea. Like, it was health-wise not a good idea to be there. The water was poisoned, the soil was questionable. Like, this was already a remote place. And it wasn't the kind of place that could be remediated by, like, hauling away the poison soil and, you know, like bringing out huge filters or something to do something about the groundwater. Like there's just, it's too remote. And
was it like a Superfund site? I forget if you mentioned that in the book or dealt with
it. I don't know if I specifically said it was a Superfund site. Mm-hmm. When did they stop naming Superfund sites? That would have been a question the copy editors would have brought up.
Yeah,
But it's not a very large island, large enough that it can be inhabited, but not large enough and remote enough that and it's privately owned, I should say, as well. It was there are privately owned islands in the San Juans, and I did base Merrow and Orwell on one of them, which has a sort of checkered history, Walden Island. But I forgot my point now. But they've come to remediate the environment, to make it better. But they've also come because, in some ways, a lot of them are sort of exclusionary. They want to be separated from, the rest of society. That, for one reason or another, that other people haven't fallen in step with maybe the environmental rigor that this group of people, they really want to sacrifice themselves for the better of the planet. Mm. And the big problem, the crux of the problem for them, is that if they're successful, then the island is habitable again and is valuable again and is a place that they might not be allowed to be anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the problems with their sort of venture into the wilderness, is that if they're successful, they may not be able to hold on to what they have.
Right. And I think that problem is going to telescope in your book, but it's surely a problem that, I don't know if problem is the best word, but it's an issue that people have had to deal with in the San Juans and certainly in mm-hmm. Southeast Alaska. I mean, people kind of dig their heels in and establish good lives here through hard work, and then all of a sudden things get easier. I mean, it's the old story. And then all of a sudden mm-hmm. property prices rise once things get easier, and
right.
and the people initially there are pushed mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, especially here in Portland, there's a lot of discussion about how waves of gentrification are like colonialism. The sort of patterns of colonialism from, Europe colonizing the New World, and that the same sort of patterns are happening over and over again, like all over the U.S., where it's like, the indigenous people or the people who, like, really busted their butts to make a place livable can no longer live there, and sort of one wave after another happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that argument. Just speaking, I mean, I'm just kind of curious about this myself, speaking of communities, I know from the last time I was in Portland a couple months ago that there were serious issues with folks camping out.
Uh-huh.
And is that still a big issue there? Has that been resolved at all? How is the city dealing with that?
I mean, it's not really dealing with it.
Yeah, okay.
There's a housing crisis here, and there are a lot of people being evicted from their homes, their once affordable homes, so that landlords can go in and I'm not talking like sort of mom and pop landlords that a lot of us probably have experienced, but like corporate landlords where the owner of the apartment building isn't even in the state. They might not even be in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It was like publicly held corporations where they buy up rental properties. And this started happening in the wake of the housing crisis. They buy up rental properties, evict the long-term tenants, slap on some new paint and maybe put in some new carpet and raise the rent. And then, the influx of higher wage people are moving in and, taking over. And gradually there are more and more people shoved to the margins and unable to find a place to live at all. And there just isn't a pattern of building a lot of affordable housing here already. So there are a lot of people camping, and it's been very cold in the last month or so. We don't get snow here a whole lot, but we had, you know, two big snow events. And we live not very far from the Columbia River Slough, which is a sort of man-made waterway to mitigate flooding. And it's wooded all around and kind of industrial at the edges of that. And we go for walks along the slough quite a bit. And just the number of tents that are popping up in the woods along the slough has been increasing steadily for the last few years. And it's, you know, it's really frustrating to not know what to do about that, or to watch the city sort of floundering and not knowing what to do about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk all day about affordable housing and something that
right.
we deal with here on the island as well. But I'm wondering if, before we lose you, maybe do you have a short section a little bit farther on in the book? Maybe like 5 minutes, something like that?
I see.
Just want to allow people to kind of get a taste of some of the action that goes on when she's on the island and you know, trying to negotiate what's going on.
Let me see. Ouch. I'm not sure how long this section is. I think it's just a couple minutes. But this is Lucy. She's just been sort of shown around an area of the island where there's some of the soil mitigation has been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't come as a surprise to some people who have seen the book, but they're using mushrooms to remediate the soil, which is sort of a new science. She's just been shown some of their operation, and now she's got a headache. She's got a really awful headache. She's had a migraine for a while, and she's been taken to see the sort of doctor of sorts on the island. Jen left me with Ellie at the apothecary. I sat on the stoop, and she took my pulse at the wrist, first on one side, then on the other. Does it have a center, or is the pain evenly spread? She asked. It's here, I said, tracing the line of pain from my eyebrow to the bridge of my nose and around to the inner socket. She took my pulse again, her steady hands on my wrist, her head cocked to the side this time like she was listening to my pulse. We hadn't met earlier. Ellie wasn't at lunch. No one had mentioned why. She had been standing in the grass near the apothecary when we walked up, staring at something in the distance. She was tall and reedy, with short dark hair that curled over half her brow. She wasn't what I thought she would be. I'd had visions of an earthy woman in layers of flowing skirts and scarves like a young Stevie Nicks. But Ellie was boyish in a worn-out T-shirt and jeans, beautiful and androgynous in a way that both men and women probably found attractive. A small sea-worn shell suspended from a silver chain around her neck landed at her sternum. My eye was drawn to it, the chalk white of the shell against the thinning white of the cotton. You didn't sleep much last night? No. Okay, come with me. She stood up and disappeared behind the screen door, and I closed my eyes. The porch was shaded, but the meadow before it was blazing in the midday sun. My eyes prickled when I looked anywhere near it. The cottage was cool and dark. I waited at the threshold for my eyes to adjust. There was a small living room with a wood stove, furnished with soft armchairs covered in pillows, a wooden table, a bookshelf stocked with volumes on folk medicine and herbalism. I squatted down to look at an amethyst and traced the crystal formations with a finger, rested my palm over the glassy curves. Ellie appeared in the arch that led to the kitchen. I've just put the water on, she said, not smiling, but not unkindly. She had a direct, gentle way about her. In the kitchen, sunlight slid around the edges of the blood-red cloth in the window, but a cool breeze blew through the back screen. I walked around the room while Ellie put herbs into a mortar and pestle at a work table and water simmered on an efficiency burner. In the place of the stove and refrigerator, there were dehydrators and drying racks, bundles of herbs hanging from them, mushrooms laid out to dry on sheets. The cupboard doors had been removed, and the shelves were lined with jars of herbs labeled with names and dates. Each shelf had a label, too, indicating the family of herbs stored there. There was an indentation in one wall that had once held a folding ironing board. The ironing board was gone, and the place now held small brown and blue dropper bottles of tinctures and flower essences. Can I touch? I was standing over a tray of dark blue fungi. Ellie looked up. Of course. What are they? Cortinarius violaceus, violet caps. About a week after the fall rains, we start collecting them. What are they for? I picked one up. It looked like a mushroom you'd buy in the grocery store, but it was the color of a varicose vein. I sniffed it. I'm not exactly sure about those. I looked at her curiously. She smiled for the first time. We only work with edible varieties at the apothecary. But part of what I'm working on for the colony is understanding what each individual has to contribute to the health of the whole. In the beginning, we work with a combination of what we know and what we can intuit from what we know. We know, for example, that Cortinarius violaceus fruits in the early fall after warm rains. So we might start by wondering whether it might be helpful for ailments induced by wet, warm weather, like certain kinds of rheumatism or influenza. Or we might wonder the opposite, if it might ameliorate ailments that are exacerbated by dry, cold climates. Cortinarius grows near conifers, but not just any conifers. It prefers amabilis fir, which are rarer than noble and Douglas firs on the islands. And perhaps that has something to do with the sweet sap the amabilis exudes. Maybe the violet caps digest the sugars of the sap, and maybe it could be indicated for blood sugar regulation. But there aren't that many people here. How often do you actually get to test these? She poured the tea through a strainer into a mug for me. It's not an allopathic model. I'll never be able to write a peer-reviewed paper or anything like that, but I don't really care. She pulled a jar of honey from the shelf and set it in front of me with a spoon. Stir a good tablespoon of honey in the tea. I did and watched the honey dissolve into some murky liquid. I took a mouthful and felt the heat and scent flow to the back of my throat and bloom up into my sinuses and around my eyes. It wasn't spicy exactly, but it had the effect of a hit of horseradish, opening my nasal passages and making my eyes water. I swallowed and felt it cool my entire throat as it went down. Oh, my God. I started laughing. The sensation passed, and I was left with the honeyed, herbaceous flavor on my tongue. Ellie raised an eyebrow. Just take sips. I'll stop there.
That's great. I'm really glad you decided to read that passage, because one of the things I wanted to chat about was foraging and mushrooms and your background in it, and also just to say it's such a big thing here on the island and something my family loves to do. Going out, we mostly have winter chanterelles here and some goldens and hedgehogs. I took a mushroom course with a woman here on the island who is just an encyclopedia. And of course we would come across the Cortinarius, the courts as they were called. And we were told in, you know, very explicitly to not pick them. They are not edible.
What
were you always interested in mushrooms? How did it become such, a central part of the book? And I know that we share an editor, Jenna Johnson at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt,
right.
And she's of course in love with mushrooms. And I wonder if she decided to take my book because of all the foraging, and maybe you wonder the same thing at times as well.
I do. You know, it's really interesting. I have wondered that. And also Gina Ochsner, who is another one of her her authors, also wrote about mushrooms in her book, just on the shelf behind me. It's The Hidden Letters of Delta B, as well. Yeah, they were kind of always in the family lore. You know, it was my grandmother, who was a Texan by birth, but homesteaded on the Kenai in the 50s.
Mm.
She had five kids, and she was a nurse. She was a community nurse, and was very scientific about her work. And she was also, you know, a woman who lived off the land and fed her family however she could. And so foraging for mushrooms was something she did. She did once accidentally poison the whole family. And
she had to start over.
One bad mushroom in the lot. And And so that's part of family lore as well. Mm. And I actually have her field guide that she used. Now she passed away this year. And and look at it and refer to it all the time.
Wow.
And but you know, I've lived in the city since I was a teenager, and mm-hmm. And here in Portland, you know, there are mushrooms everywhere, and once you start seeing them, they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can go out on my lawn right now probably and find some, you know, little mycena or something popping out of the moss.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly when I started writing this book, I knew I was going to use mushrooms, and I was reading Paul Stamets, who's a famous Washington mushroom guy.
Sure, yeah.
And he wrote Mycelium Running, which was a huge influence on this book, or resource for me.
Mm-hmm.
I run in the forest. I'm a trail runner, and I was running in Forest Park. And when I started researching, I started seeing all the mushrooms. And so I would take my phone with me, and every time I saw a mushroom, I would stop running, and I would, you know, drop down and start taking pictures of it. And I would go home and get out my guidebooks and go on the forums online and figure out what the mushroom was. And,
oh, cool.
And so I sort of in that way became an amateur mycologist. And, you know, there's still so much I don't know. But it's fascinating once you get sort of sucked into it. It's pretty amazing. And just the powers of mushrooms, and you know, there's a mushroom that like invades the brain of an ant and mm-hmm. slowly kills it, and you know, it's just really fascinating. So that's definitely one of those things that got I sort of went down the wormhole and never quite came back, even after finishing the book.
Yeah, gosh, yeah. The more I've learned and you know read about mushrooms, the more I'm convinced that they just come from another planet. I mean, they're so crazy in what they're able to do in woods and how they attach themselves to trees and mm-hmm. and how little is known about them. It seems their kind of inner workings.
Right.
They're just the coolest things out there and so weird looking. I mean, I love that they're like the octopus of land or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're somewhere between plant and animal to me. You know, they have the different ones they have different personalities and. You know, there's dead man's fingers, or there's the stinkhorn, or, you know, there are so many, or even just a morel, you know, they're so weird looking. And then you realize that that's just the what we see of them, you know, that they're actually just like enormous networks of their organism underground doing all of this work that we are just unaware of, you know, they're connecting species of plants. They're performing a function in the ecosystem that, you know, we as humans just haven't studied enough, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah. Well, just to come, you know, full circle back to your book, I think, you know, the stories, I think there's so much, you know, they're there on the surface and they can be recited over and over again and harvested over and over again, but all that work beneath the surface, you know, in our subconscious and, you know,
mm-hmm.
arranging our lives and giving us lessons in ways that we don't entirely understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that people can be dismissive about, you know, beach reading or genre fiction or even things like thriller. But it's just nice to read a book that is obviously written by somebody with a grasp on literary fiction, who nevertheless pays good attention to the story. And, if, you know, as you tell the story about needing characters for your baseball team and Randy Johnson and whatever, you know, characters obviously are developed. Lucy's a beautiful character, as is Carrie and Katie and Sister Janet. But you know, you don't shirk from a good narrative, which I really appreciated in Marrow Island. Yeah. Well, we just have a couple more minutes left. Do you want to finish up maybe by taking a minute or two just to let us know what you're working on?
Yeah, I'm kind of in an in-between place.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a new book sort of percolating in my head, and it will take on landscape in a different way. I think it's going to be a bit more So it'll be a little drier, and not in a not in a boring way. It'll be, they'll probably take place sort of high plains, kind of eastern Washington, mm-hmm. eastern Oregon. It'll be a bit more of that kind of landscape, and farming communities, geological communities, or communities that interact with mining and things like that, and hopefully a good story. Sort of the hard part,
yeah.
to find a place and details, but finding the people who need to be there is kind of the hard part, is putting the whole story together.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that you're kind of underpinning your story with, again, kind of this industrial backbone, in the same way that you did in Merrill Island. It kept it from going too far in the air. You know, it's got a real kind of working backbone to it, which was great. Yeah, well, good luck with that. And I hope you find much writing time and perhaps join back up with Jenna for another go at it. In the meantime, please, if you're ever in the neighborhood, well, you should just come up here to Sitka. I think you'd really enjoy it. And
I would love to. You know, I have never been to Sitka.
No, oh, well,
We didn't travel all that much off the Kenai, so it was like Seward, Anchorage, Kenai, Sulana, Homer.
Yeah, well,
I would love to see Sitka.
I have a real feeling that you would just fall in love with the place. So do whenever your path brings you up here. And in the meantime, I so appreciate you taking the time to chat with us about Merrill Island and the book. You should be able to get it at Old Harbor Books here in town. And do read it. It's a great story, and it's one that I think will ring a lot of bells for people here on the island. So thank you so much, Alexis, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
And thanks for listening to Raven Anthology, and we will be seeing you next time. Bye.